Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Questions of justice. Attorney General William Barr testifies before Congress on the use of force against protesters and allegations of the politicization of the Justice Department. Then, counteracting coronavirus, Congress struggles to find common ground as the current round of COVID relief is set to expire. Plus, rethinking college. COVID-19 raises questions about the cost of living on campus amid lawsuits over full tuition for remote learning.
We want colleges and universities to really rethink their business model, rethink how they serve students, and rethink how they deliver an education.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Negotiations over another pandemic aid package are intensifying on Capitol Hill, with federal jobless benefits set to expire on Friday. Today's talks came as COVID cases nationwide topped 4.3 million, with 148,000 deaths. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows met with Senate Republicans, but Majority Leader Mitch McConnell acknowledged his caucus is divided.
There are some members who think we've already done enough. Other members who think we need to do more. This is a complicated problem. We've done the best we can to develop a consensus among the broadest number of Republican senators, and that's just the starting place. That's just where we begin in dealing with the other side and with the administration.
Later, President Trump says that he does not support parts of the Republican bill. He did not elaborate. Meanwhile, McConnell said that he opposes including nearly $2 billion for a new FBI headquarters near the Trump Hotel in Washington. He said the White House insisted on including it. There is word this evening that Russia is using English language websites to spread disinformation about the pandemic. The New York Times and the Associated Press say top Russian military intelligence operatives are targeting American and Western audiences. The reports cite U.S. government officials and newly declassified information. U.S. Attorney General William Barr defended his use of federal forces against civil unrest today. He told the House Judiciary Committee that, quote, violent rioters and anarchists have hijacked legitimate protests. Democrats charged Barr has misused the Justice Department to defend President Trump. We'll get much more after the news summary. The mayor of Portland, Oregon, Ted Wheeler, is pressing for a ceasefire and the removal of federal agents from his city. Overnight, agents again used tear gas after some protesters attacked a security fence at the federal courthouse. They've gathered near the site for 2 months. The Democratic presidential nominee-to-be, Joe Biden, called today for using economic aid to address racial inequities. It includes billions of dollars for minority-owned businesses and a tax credit for home ownership. The former vice president spoke in Wilmington, Delaware, and contrasted his approach with President Trump's.
He's shown that he can't beat the pandemic and keep you safe. He can't turn the economy around and get America back to work. And he is horrifyingly and not surprisingly intentionally stoking the flames of division and racism in this country.
The proposals that Biden highlighted today are part of larger economic plans that he began to lay out earlier. The Trump administration will impose new curbs on DACA. That's the program that bars deporting people brought to the U.S. illegally as children. Under revised rules, new applications will be denied and renewals will be cut from 2 years to one. The administration is still mulling a way to end the program that will pass muster with the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll have more on the story a little later in the program. Thousands of people file past the U.S. Capitol throughout this day as the body of the late Congressman John Lewis lay in state. They stood in socially distanced lines well into the evening to pay respects to the civil rights icon. Lewis's funeral will be Thursday in Atlanta. There's more economic fallout from the coronavirus. The Business Group Conference Board reports that consumer confidence fell this month as new infections surged. The Federal Reserve has extended 7 emergency lending programs through year's end to aid in economic recovery. And the Miami Marlins pro baseball team has canceled its games through Sunday after 15 players tested positive. And on Wall Street today, weak corporate earnings weighed stocks down. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 205 points to close at 26,379. The Nasdaq fell 134 points, and the S&P 500 slipped 21. Still to come on the NewsHour, Attorney General William Barr testifies before Congress on the use of force against protesters. Congress struggles to find common ground as the current round of COVID relief is set to expire. COVID-19 raises questions about the cost of living on campus amid lawsuits over full tuition for remote learning, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Delayed for 4 months because of the pandemic, Attorney General William Barr faced questions from the House Judiciary Committee in a combative hearing that lasted more than 4 hours. In Barr's first testimony in more than a year, Democrats questioned him about protests in Portland, about Roger Stone's commuted prison sentence, the Russia investigation, and much more. Capitol Hill correspondent Lisa Desjardins has our report.
Please rise. I will begin by swearing you in.
At the Capitol, a socially distanced confrontation over justice itself, with Democrats sharply charging that Attorney General William Barr is a puppet for President Trump.
In your time at the department, you have aided and abetted the worst failings of the president.
And with Barr insisting any decisions were his alone, not Mr. Trump's.
He has told me from the start that he expects me to exercise my independent judgment to make whatever call I think is right, and that is precisely what I've done.
The hearing covered well-known flashpoints, among them the case of President Trump's friend and advisor, Roger Stone, convicted of obstruction and lying to Congress. Barr overruled prosecutors in the case to recommend a lower sentence than they had. Barr told Democrats it was the only time he's done that in this administration, but that it was because the original recommendation was way out of line with norms.
No, that's not
the judge
what I'm,
agreed
I'm
with
not
me.
Asking you that.
The judge
Kirk.
Agreed
I'm
with me.
I'm not asking whether.
I know you're not asking.
I'm not asking
I'm
you
saying.
That. And the issue here is whether Roger Stone was treated differently because he was friends with the president.
Democrats sometimes spoke over the attorney general, and often Republicans like Mike Johnson of Louisiana gave him their time to answer and defend himself.
I'm supposedly punishing the president's enemies and helping his friends. What enemies have I indicted? Who could you point to one indictment that has been under the department that you feel is unmerited, that you feel violates the rule of law?
The hearing was not just about Trump and politics, but also about the past few months of protest, violence, and police confrontations, including the Trump administration's response recently in Portland, Oregon. And more directly for Barr, who was nearby, the use of force to clear out protesters near the White House on June 1st.
And the protesters aren't mobs. They are mothers and veterans and mayors. In this moment, real leadership would entail de-escalation, collaboration, and looking for ways to peaceably resolve our differences. Instead, you use pepper spray and truncheons on American citizens.
Barr defended the response as necessary, pointing out police and property have been harmed, and a federal building has repeatedly been targeted in Portland.
We are on the defense. We're not out looking for trouble. And if the state and the city would provide the law enforcement services that other jurisdictions do, we would have no need to have additional marshals in the courthouse.
Above it all, a broader question about policing.
Does the Trump Justice Department seek to end systemic racism and racism in law enforcement? I just need a yes or no answer.
I don't agree that there's systemic racism in the police department.
Specifically,
generally in this country.
But in a separate hearing today, a D.C. National Guard member spoke out against the federal police response to protests. Major Adam DeMarco told the House Natural Resources Committee what he saw when authorities moved against the demonstration near the White House on June 1st.
From my observation, those demonstrators, our fellow American citizens, were engaged in the peaceful expression of their First Amendment rights. Yet they were subjected to an unprovoked escalation and excessive use of force.
That hearing's other witness, Acting Park Police Chief Gregory Monahan, testified that protesters had been combative for days, and the decision to move on them was made by his officers, not by the White House, because they anticipated more violence. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
The battle over the emergency unemployment benefits that millions of Americans had been receiving is a big dividing point in the debate over a COVID relief package. Democrats say the extra $600 should be extended until at least the end of the year. The president, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and many Republicans have said the benefit should be lowered to $200 through part of the fall. And it would then, they say, be tapered to 70% of what a worker's salary was before he or she lost their job. We're going to look at these ideas and the possible impact with Austin Goolsbee. He's the former head of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Obama. He's now at the University of Chicago. And Michael Strain. He's an economist with the American Enterprise Institute. He's testified before Congress and he advises Republicans. Welcome, both of you, to the NewsHour. Austin Goolsbee, if you're there, I haven't seen you, but I think you're with us. The Republicans are arguing, most of them, many of them, that this $600 additional is something the government, I'm told we don't have Austin Goolsbee. Let me turn to you, Michael Strain. What is the argument for going from 600 additional to 200 a month? As you know, so many of these workers have lost their jobs. They haven't had the option to go back to work. That's a significant cut, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a significant cut. And that's an issue that Congress should address in a way other than by continuing the $600 federal supplement to state-provided unemployment benefits. The argument against continuing them, or the argument for the cut, is that as the economy continues to recover and as the labor market continues to strengthen, paying people that much money in unemployment benefits that are conditioned on being unemployed will keep people out of the workforce and will keep the unemployment rate higher than it otherwise would be. It will serve as a disincentive to leave the unemployment rolls and to get a job. And the reason for that is because at $600 a week in a federal supplement, average UI benefits are around $950 a week. And that's more weekly income than most people who are receiving unemployment benefits would make if they went and got a job. So the incentive is to stay unemployed.
Well, I think we now have Austin Goolsbee. Welcome to the NewsHour. Austin, I don't know if you were able to hear Michael Strain, but his point is that a lot of people just don't have an incentive to go back to work because they're being paid more than they were even earning in the first place.
Yeah. You hear that a lot from the Republicans. The only things I'd say about that are, number one, that's not exactly how the unemployment system works. If you look at unemployment insurance, you can't quit your job and get unemployment, and you have to be searching for work. And if you're offered a job and turn it down, you're no longer eligible for unemployment insurance. The second is, this is a mentality which is coming from a normal time in the labor market. And this is emphatically not a normal time in the labor market. The reason people are out of work is...
Go ahead.
...is that the virus is raging out of control. So I think the evidence shows that there are not people... if you look at the generosity of unemployment insurance, it's not at all correlated with the unemployment rate. I don't think that's what's driving things.
Michael Strain, what about that point that we are in a very unusual situation, millions of people thrown out of work through no action of their own, and this is a way to, frankly, keep them whole, keep them able to pay their rent, to provide what their families need?
Yeah, I would say two things to that. You know, the first is that I agree with Austin that the evidence to date suggests that the generosity of unemployment benefits is not keeping people on the unemployment rolls. But the policy question facing Congress is not whether we should have the $600 supplement in the month of July or whether we should have had it in the months of May and June. The question is whether we should have it throughout the fall and into the winter and to the end of calendar year 2020. And I think that as the year continues, as the economy continues to recover, as the labor market continues to strengthen, we're going to be more and more in kind of a normal recession. And in that event, the $600 supplement would serve the purpose that it normally would, which is to keep people unemployed. I think and you're right, Judy, that these benefits are really important for families, particularly low-income families. So if Congress does cut the generosity of the benefit, I hope they find a different way to get low-income households the income support that they need during this really weak economy. But you know, the choice between disincentivizing people from going back to work and supporting consumer spending is a false choice.
Well, let me come back to you, Austin, because it sounds to me as if Michael Strain, and he can correct me later if he wants, is saying that he expects the economy to get somewhat back on track, will be in more of a, quote, normal recession in the fall, and the normal unemployment benefits should suffice. What about that?
Well, I mean, that's kind of the hinge pin. My view is if you want to put in automatic triggers, that we start reducing the unemployment benefits once you get the unemployment rate down to something like normal levels, fine, we should have a discussion like that. But what's happening here is you've got a microeconomic problem and a macro problem. The micro problem is the unemployment rate is double digits. These people lost their jobs through no fault of their own. They're not sitting at home because they want a vacation. And everybody recognizes that. And they're talking about sometime in the future when they think that it would be the disincentive problem. The macroeconomic problem is this is a massive number of people who the evidence shows this supplement to their unemployment insurance is the only thing maintaining their consumer spending. There's going to be a dramatic drop off of the spending levels of these people if they're cut off. And there'd probably be millions who are evicted from their homes. So I think that runs the risk of snowballing this into a deeper downturn as opposed to extending the downturn.
Michael Strain, you're not concerned about that?
Well, I just think it's a false choice. I mean, the choice is not between keeping in place a program that strongly disincentivizes people to go back to work as the economy strengthens and as the labor market recovers and supporting consumer spending. You can reduce the generosity of unemployment insurance benefits and reduce the disincentive to go back to work while also supporting consumer spending by increasing transfers to households, particularly low-income households.
So you're saying
that's what I would urge
provide money through a different channel. But Michael Strain, let me just ask you, you're also assuming the economy is going to get better, right? I mean, and I'm curious to know what you base that on, because right now the coronavirus is raging as for weeks on end.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think there's very little chance that we're going to see an economy that is as bad as the economy was in March, April and May. You know, consensus forecasts suggest that the unemployment rate will be lower in December of this year than it is now, that the economy will be stronger in December of this year than it is now. We may have a kind of stop and start economy in the fall where, you know, we take three steps forward and one step back. That seems to be what's happened this summer. We took big steps forward in May and June. We may have taken a step back in July. But I think the consensus.
Let me just interrupt you there, because I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to give Austin Goolsbee a chance here at the end to respond, because I think what he's saying is that he does expect the economy to get better.
Yeah, look, and I hope he's right. And I appreciate that Michael's argument is if you're not going to give UI money, then we need to give money to ordinary people in some other form. That's not really what the argument is in Washington right now. It's to reduce the amount of people. And I think if the virus starts raging out of control again, we're going to have another downturn. And the thing that's keeping people out of work now is that there's not demand. And this same mentality was with us at the outset of the crisis, when the same people argued that there should not be a national paid sick leave policy at no cost to workers, because they said it would disincentivize them from going to work. But I wish we had had that policy, because one of the major sources of infection has turned out to be people with symptoms going to work because they needed the money and getting their coworkers sick. So I just think the virus is the boss here. We've got to control this virus. And once the virus is under control, then we can go back to a more normal labor market. But until that happens, you've got to support people.
Well, these are the very same, or at least some of the very same debates we know they're having right now on Capitol Hill. I want to thank both of you for joining us. Austin Goolsbee, Michael Strain, thank you. The pandemic, for now anyway, has upended the traditional model of higher education, and particularly for residential colleges, as many schools announce plans to charge full tuition while continuing with remote education. Some are questioning what those tuition dollars are actually paying for and if it's worth it. Hari Srinivasan reports now on a new effort to rethink the value and the cost of the traditional four-year experience in the COVID-19 era. His story is part of our Rethinking College series.
Before the pandemic, leaving home and moving into a college dorm was a rite of passage for many young adults.
You have a desk that comes with the room.
I'm just now getting around to posting my dorm room tour.
Some students even took to YouTube to share their campus experiences. But late night pizza runs, the freshman 15, studying on the quad, none of those things can happen easily online.
I really like where I am right now. It's super close to the dining hall. And
Stanford student Cyan Danjou is one of those who enjoyed documenting dorm life and is now missing it.
The residential experience for myself and a lot of students around my age, the first time that we're starting to build new skills, build new relationships, and really have our independence and make decisions for ourselves.
Now, as she heads into her junior year, when most of her classes will be remote, Danjou says she's questioning the value of that educational experience, and she may take some time off.
When we're making this decision whether the tuition we're paying is worth it, yes, the classes are there and they're valuable, but it's about the entire experience. It's about having a diverse class of people, diverse sets of interests that are talking to you. And
while Danjou and many other students around the country are debating how to approach this era of remote learning, there is little debate that getting a four-year degree is generally worth it, with significantly higher lifetime earnings for most. But the cost of those degrees has skyrocketed, roughly doubling over the past several decades, leading to more than $1.6 trillion in national student loan debt. Over the years, those costs and other factors have made the residential college experience inaccessible for many lower income and students of color. So now, in the new COVID era, when so much is being upended in higher education, some are arguing there's no better time to rethink what college looks like after the pandemic.
The model of higher education that we are delivering in the U.S. has been based on this residential experience that cost about twice what an education cost in Europe.
That's Richard Aram, Dean of the School of Education at the University of California, Irvine. Last September, he and his colleagues began a first-of-its-kind study to try and better understand the value and cost of a four-year liberal arts education, where students often live on or near campus and are exposed to a wide variety of subjects.
We believe that there's something about the residential college experience that is useful for human development and growth for these students, whether that's worth $10,000, $20,000, $40,000 a year, in addition, for 4 years, is an open question.
The study, which is funded by the Mellon Foundation, also a NewsHour supporter, is tracking a diverse cohort of 1,200 UCI students over 3 years to learn how they're learning and what aspects of their education help them to succeed. Arum says that what makes the project so unique is the type of data being collected, about 100 different metrics, ranging from weekly surveys on mental health and stress to tracking time spent in online classes.
I think it's possible, given the complexity of our data, to attempt to get at that.
On a recent afternoon, Arum and his team met virtually to go over new survey results.
62% of the students reported that they do have new responsibilities.
Their early data showed students were less engaged with online studies when they reported the lack of a quiet study space and new family responsibilities at home. That kind of information was immediately helpful for Michael Denon, the university's vice provost for teaching and learning.
That really has to inform how we advise our faculty and how we train them this summer to think about their teaching, because we're not used to thinking about all the other stuff that's going on outside of their courses.
Michelle Cooper is also thinking about the future.
We want colleges and universities to really rethink their business model, rethink how they serve students, and rethink how they deliver an education.
She's the president of the Institute for Higher Education Policy and one of the leaders of a national group now studying the economic and non-economic returns of education after high school. Cooper says there needs to be more awareness that the benefits of a residential college experience were not accessible to everyone.
Social capital that's provided through these sort of traditional brick and mortar residential colleges is something that many people have always known was there, but never really talked about in a very upfront and open way. That is certainly something that we have seen many low-income students struggle with. If you are attending a community college and you kind of, you know, go to school and you go back home or you go to work, like, you don't know where to often go to establish those relationships with individuals who can help you get that leg up in employment.
That was the experience of Walter Ramirez, who became the first in his family to graduate from college in June. He spent several years at a community college before transferring to UC Irvine and living on campus. He says the connections he made there have given him a big boost as he prepares to enter the workplace.
At UC Irvine, I learned how to, you know, talk to professors and work with them on a research project or ask if I could assist them with a research project. And that's how I started building relationships with professors. And eventually they began to support me with letters of recommendation for scholarships or internship opportunities or even job applications.
For his part, Richard Arum says he hopes his study will help students and colleges better understand what aspects of the residential college experience are important to preserve and what could be tweaked to bring down costs and expand access, issues that are more relevant than ever.
It's quite likely that the economy that comes out of this crisis is going to look structurally different than the one we started with. The post-secondary system is going to be responsible not just for educating the same number of students we have in the past, but dramatically more students. We need to experiment. We need to innovate to ensure workforce development and economic competitiveness for our society.
Arum and his team plan to release initial results from their study in the fall. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Hari Srinivasan.
Throughout the pandemic, the president and his team are continuing to pursue policies cracking down on immigration. Today, the administration said that it will try to find ways to wind down and limit a program that protects Dreamers from deportation. Dreamers are the immigrants who arrived or remained in the U.S. illegally as children and haven't lived most of their lives here. It's one of several moves of late. Our Amna Nawaz has been following all of this closely, and she joins me now. So, Amna, today what the administration has done, this is a program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival. This is something the administration has been trying to end for months. The Supreme Court has turned them down. So help us understand what exactly the administration is trying today.
Well, the move today, Judy, basically further undermines the program. It's currently shielding about 700,000 people from deportation. The Trump administration announced today it will no longer accept new applications for that DACA program. It's going to limit renewals for 1 year rather than the 2-year standard. All of this, it said, while it, quote unquote, reviews the program. Now, you mentioned the Supreme Court had said the Trump administration can't end the DACA program. It's not because they thought the president doesn't have the authority to do it. It's just they didn't agree with the way that they were going about doing it. So that left the door open for the administration to try again. Today's move makes it seem like the president is not done trying. So, Judy, most people I talked to today said there are sure to be more legal challenges ahead.
So there's another legal fight, as you know, Amna, on another immigration front from this administration. This one is about 100 children who are in immigration detention. A judge has ordered that these children be released. The deadline for that to happen was last night. Tell us what the latest is.
That's right, Judy. So those 100 or so children are held in what's called family residential centers. Those are run by ICE. There's 3 of them across both Texas and Pennsylvania. They're federal immigration detention. And the judge did order those children to be released because the law says kids shouldn't be in those facilities longer than 20 days. Most of those children have been there much longer. But the judge's order did not extend to the parents, and therein lies the problem. So ICE officials are now presenting parents with a choice. They're saying, sign a consent form, waive your child's rights, and remain together in federal detention or voluntarily separate. Allow us to take your child, place that child with a family member or a sponsor family or government custody. Critics are now calling this family separation 2.0. Now, I did ask ICE for a response to all of this and to that legal deadline from the judge they appeared to have missed, and this is what they said. We're unable to comment due to ongoing litigation. However, the most recent decision from that judge paves the way for the parties to continue to dialogue in anticipation of providing an update to the district court by August 5th. So, Judy, it looks like they are working with the judge to try to get more time to try to figure out how to handle those kids' cases and not release the families together, which they really don't want to do. Judy?
Such a concerning report, and Amna, still another concerning report. This one, first reported by the Associated Press, has to do with unaccompanied children being kept in hotels along the border. Obviously, there was pushback. What's the administration saying now?
So, Judy, what typically happens when kids come into custody is they're transferred over to the government agency responsible for the care and custody of migrant children. They have medical and legal and educational resources. The report found that ICE was actually keeping custody with a contractor holding children in hotels and then within days deporting them back to their home countries. That was without any evaluation of what they were sending the kids back to. That, of course, is concerning on a number of levels. I asked ICE for a response to this as well. They said there's pending litigation, so they can't really talk about it. But any official I talked to today, including former government officials, said it's concerning when it comes to child welfare interests for a number of reasons. These ICE contractors are not trained to handle the care and custody of children in the same way the other government agency is. Judy?
And finally, Amna, when you step back and you look at all of these moves, what the administration's trying to do, whether they're talking about it or not, what does this all add up to?
Judy, it's all in keeping with the president's ongoing efforts to limit immigration, both illegal and legal. I think most people are struck, however, by the fact that children have typically been the exception, that any child seeking safe haven in the U.S. has been granted that, and that's no longer the case. I actually spoke to a former senior ICE official, a man named Andrew Lorenzen Strait, who left the administration just about a year ago. He called the decision to house kids in hotels without due process abhorrent. He said there are other ways that families in detention can be released together and still comply with the law. He said in his time in the office, they worked to make sure they were enforcing the nation's immigration laws, but maintaining humanitarian standards. And Judy, he told me this seemingly went out the door with the current administration. Judy?
So many important pieces of this story. One of those stories that hasn't gotten a lot of attention because of the pandemic and so much else going on. Really important to be following this. Amna, thank you.
Thanks, Judy.
The Congo Basin rainforest is the second largest on Earth, home to unique biodiversity. But even its remoteness cannot protect wildlife like gorillas and elephants from the threat of extinction from poaching. With the support of the Pulitzer Center, late last year, before COVID-19, special correspondent Monica Villamizar and videographer Phil Coller traveled to Janga Janga Wildlife Reserve in Central African Republic to join indigenous tribal hunters who have turned gamekeepers to protect Africa's most endangered wildlife.
Bonda Blaise is following animal tracks through the forest. He is a member of the Bayaka Pygmies. Men and women hunt together, encircling the area with nets. They don't use firearms, which are illegal to use for hunting within the Zanga Zanga Natural Park, only machetes and spears. They are looking for small animals and edible plants. All are expert trackers and imitate animal noises to drive their prey towards the nets. This isn't a sport, it's survival, and each day they must go further into the forest for the hunt.
Our forests are being emptied of animals by poachers who hunt completely irresponsibly without following the rules.
The Bayaka believe the forest is sacred. This chant is a ritual asking for good luck. They are one of the last hunter-gatherer communities in the world. Their diet is made up of plants and nuts they collect from the forest, and their source of protein comes from wild animals they hunt. If they fail to catch anything, their village will go without meat. After 4 hours of hard work in the humid jungle, some of the women have managed to trap a porcupine in its den. They dig carefully, knowing that if it escapes, all of their efforts will be worth nothing. It does not, and celebration follows. Back at the village, Blaise shows us his home. His community was traditionally nomadic, but now lives in a settlement at the edge of the forest. They have few employment prospects and are seen as the lowest class of ethnic groups in the area.
I live here with my wife and 5 children. Tomorrow morning, I'll leave home early to go to my job as a park ranger.
Working as a park ranger is one of the few jobs on offer to the Bayaka. The natural park is divided into areas. Most of it is off limits to loggers and all types of hunters, sport hunters and poachers. But a few areas have been designated for traditional hunt, which is what the Bayaka do, hunting for sustenance. Zanga Zanga is one of the remaining sanctuaries for species like the forest elephant, pangolins, and gorillas, all highly prized by poachers. Protecting these animals is the park ranger's main task, and they have a fight on their hands. Colonel Christian Nadet, one of the chief rangers in the park, says poaching has caused major damage to the animal population. And seizures of ivory, pangolin scales, and illegal weapons have gone up 80% in the last 5 years. Poaching is carried out both by well-organized armed criminal gangs and by local villagers trying to make a fast buck.
Does it trap gorillas and like their hands, I heard, right?
Yes, it can catch gorillas and other large animals. It's very dangerous and it doesn't discriminate between females or infants. Whatever the size, the animal is caught in the trap and can't escape.
Gorillas are poached for their meat and body parts, which are used in traditional medicine or sold as trophies.
All of these tusks are from forest elephants. Our park rangers are the only thing that continues to guarantee the natural richness of this area.
The rangers program is one of the first to incorporate local community members like the Bayaka. It's a multi-agency partnership. The rangers are employed by the government and supported by the World Wildlife Fund and an anti-poaching nonprofit called Shengeta. The founder, Rory Young, recently introduced Dutch-trained Cocker Spaniels to detect ivory, weapons, and illegal bushmeat.
They know that means they're going to go and work, which to them is play. So they're going to run in there in a hurry, like, let's go, let's go, let's go.
Today, Blaise's unit and the 2 dogs, Bobby and Mitch, are searching for contraband at a checkpoint. The rangers are the local police in the park, and they carefully check their weapons. Each bullet is precious. There is limited ammo to go around, and they have to share 3 assault rifles. Blaise and his unit have come under fire by poachers several times. It's a high-risk job. Freddy, the dog handler, practices the search before the real work begins.
C'est ça qui m'aide.
I love my work here.
This job helps me feed my family. My parents are really proud.
The dogs help the rangers a lot, but they also have a psychological effect because the community will start speaking and it will spread by word of mouth that there are these trained animals that can detect illegal goods. And this dissuades people from poaching.
Each ranger makes $150 a month, which is three times the average salary in the Central African Republic. Come, meet. Deep in the Zangazanga forest are the critically endangered lowland gorillas. Bayaka trackers are helping scientists study the gorillas with their local knowledge of the forest and their ability to locate the elusive primate.
From now on, we have to be really, really quiet because we're getting very close to them.
The exact number of these animals left in the wild is unknown, but scientists estimate that hunting, logging, and disease have wiped out more than 60% of the population in the last 20 years.
It's a perfect storm of destruction facing not only the gorillas, but the forest elephants and many other species and these forests as a whole.
Gorilla meat is sold in the market. Some people think it will give them the animal strength. Ghislain Malgebade used to believe this myth, and now he's one of the gorilla researchers.
I've discovered that gorillas are just like human beings. Before I started working here, I didn't know that gorillas act exactly like we do.
Scientists and rangers collect data on the ground and send it to St. Louis, Missouri, to Dr. Odine Serrano. A former NASA scientist, she plots on a map the information from the ranger patrols, weather satellites, and data from GPS collars placed on elephants and gorillas.
The novelty is the correlation between wildlife trafficking and intelligence gathering and execution.
This research is helping to predict where poachers are likely to strike, allowing the rangers to better deploy their forces. After a several hours trek through dense jungle and across rivers, the forest gives way to a huge clearing, Zangabai, or the village of elephants. Unlike their savanna cousins, the forest elephants have denser tusks, which fetches a higher price on the black market. They have come to Zangabai to access mineral salts in the mud to prevent them from dehydration. There can be hundreds of elephants in the bay at a given time.
So elephants are a keystone species. So many other species depend on them being in the forest. And we depend on these forests. I mean, the air we breathe comes from these trees.
Poachers sell these tusks for up to $2,000 a gram. The coveted pink ivory is mostly destined for markets in Asia, the US, and Europe. Young warns that if poaching is allowed to continue unchecked, the rainforest can be completely emptied of wildlife.
With an empty forest syndrome, you don't have any animals, you just have the trees. And you get a lot of undergrowth, thick undergrowth, and it's even harder to get animals back into those forests.
Last year, poaching trends started to decrease thanks to the ranger program, according to Young. But it's a constant battle to stay one step ahead of the poachers. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Monica Villamizar in the Central African Republic.
She is one of our most acclaimed poets, a two-time poet laureate and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for her collection, Native Guard. Now, Natasha Trethewey has written a memoir of her childhood, the murder of her mother, and her own calling as a poet. The book is published today, and Jeffrey Brown has this conversation for our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas.
3 weeks gone, my mother came to me in a dream, her body whole again, but for one perfect wound.
In the poem Articulation, Natasha Trethewey writes of the violent death of her mother and how that forever shaped her own life and work.
How then could I not answer her life with mine, she who saved me with hers? And how could I not, bathed in the light of her wound, find my calling there?
Natasha Trethewey was born to a black mother, Gwendolyn Turnbow, and white father, Eric Trethewey. It was 1966 in Mississippi. Mixed-race marriages had only recently been legalized, but Jim Crow customs continued. In 1972, her parents divorced. Her father, who became a poet and English professor, died in 2014. The young Natasha spent her teenage years in Atlanta, where her mother met and married another man, Joel Grimet, who would beat, abuse, and in 1985, murder her. Natasha was 19 at the time. Now at 54, she's written Memorial Drive, a daughter's memoir.
I am trying to pay homage to her, but also trying to remember her, trying to get back a little bit of what I buried and tried to forget so many years because parts of it were painful.
You write about how at a certain point you realized that abuse was taking place, that she was being beaten. And you write about knowing it, not wanting to know it.
I think that that's the kind of way that trauma can divide you. You can be conscious of something, but try so hard to bury it so as not to feel the pain of it. I think that's what I was trying to do, trying to live with a smile on my face as if that weren't the story behind it.
And then you describe yourself sort of shutting down for years on end, right? Kind of losing years, turning away, trying to forget, but of course, never really forgetting.
I think that the body does not let you forget. Trauma waits to remind you that it still exists inside in myriad ways, and it kept finding me.
When she became a public figure as poet laureate, Natasha saw articles written about her make her mother's killing almost a kind of footnote.
And I thought if that was going to continue to happen, that I needed to be the one to tell her story so that she could be put in her proper context as the reason that I am a writer.
Over the years, taking notes on legal pads and in notebooks, she pieced together memories, dreams, police and court documents, and more, all incorporated into the book. At one point, she even writes in the second person, addressing her younger self.
The second person was an attempt to show that kind of split in my mind, trying to divide myself from the self that's experiencing that trauma. And so I wanted to enact that in the prose by speaking to the self. And that section ends, you know, look at you, even now, you're trying to distance yourself from that.
Ask yourself what's in your heart, that reliquary.
As her memoir makes clear, there's no distance between the trauma and the writer Natasha became. Her most recent collection, Monument, contains some of her most direct poems about her mother. And we saw it up close, the empathy and focus on how stories impact lives, in the year-long NewsHour series, Where Poetry Lives.
It's a perfect day.
When our travels with Natasha, then poet laureate, took us to a Brooklyn dementia program.
I started writing because I didn't have another way to cope.
A Seattle writing workshop for troubled teens.
What kinds of things have you written about?
A Detroit elementary school.
We all tell ourselves stories about our lives, whether we are writers or not. That's the way that we give meaning and purpose and shape to what seems chaotic, random. Being able to do that, to tell a story, to tell one's own story, I think is empowering.
You write of how eventually it's story, it's metaphor, eventually it's poetry. Those are the things that helped you come to understand what had happened and how you, in fact, survived.
The facts sometimes are difficult and banal, but seeing them through the lens of metaphor helped me see that what seemed merely senseless is, if I think about my own calling to be a writer, it redeems what would otherwise be senseless, gives it meaning and purpose.
So you see a direct line from all of this in becoming the writer that you became?
Absolutely. I don't think I'd be a writer without that existential wound. As Lorca pointed out, that in trying to heal the wound that never heals lies the strangeness in an artist's work, that kind of awareness of death, that can make something not just beautiful, but something also meaningful in a different way. I think at 19, I was telling myself that I had experienced that wound and that I would have to make something of it. And as Rumi said, the wound is the place where the light enters you. And it did.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
Now to a very different story. Cannabidiol, or CBD, products are everywhere right now. And the growing trend is not only fashionable, it's also big business. It can be derived from both hemp and cannabis, with the hemp extraction used to produce fabrics, oils, and food. From the Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University, Marcela Bayeto spoke to one Navajo leader before the pandemic who has jumped at this growing business opportunity. But some within his own tribe are saying, not so fast.
In the heart of the Navajo Nation, not far from the Four Corners, where Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Utah meet, millions of hemp plants are growing, many of them ready to be harvested. It's the first time this kind of plant is being grown on such a massive scale on the Navajo Nation. Hemp plants contain less than 3% of THC, so they cannot get you high, but Danae Banali says the crop provides his community with a natural health and wellness product.
Doing this project, I really got to know what our people are really made of, you know, what type of skill set, what kind of issues we're dealing with, alcoholism, methamphetamines, opiates abuse.
Harlan Joe is a manager on the farm, and he's struggled with substance abuse. He says life on the farm has given him a second chance at life.
I used to be an alcoholic, too. I used to be on the streets, drink around, shiprock. And when Danae told me to take over, changed my life, you know.
Just getting the buds.
The farm is providing job opportunities for nearly 100 employees like Delbert Etzity in a community that has high unemployment.
We're actually standing here and doing this right here just because we believed in something that couldn't be done.
This hemp will eventually become the main ingredient in Navajo Gold products, the CBD company Banali started in early October.
This can replace that.
The new harvesting and processing of the hemp all takes place on the Navajo Nation. Hemp plants like these are turned into lotions, oils, and even edibles.
It doesn't have to be smokable.
With CBD oil, a substance derived from hemp that is not intoxicating but which many believe helps with medical issues like arthritis and anxiety. Navajo Gold employee Anthony Lee calls himself a plant health advocate and says the Navajo Nation is an ideal place to grow this crop.
We have land and we have water. For instance, we only use about 20% of the farmlands located along the San Juan River.
On his 300 acres, Banali and his farmers can grow up to 2.5 million hemp plants. But this crop comes with some caveats. The U.S. Agriculture Department and tribal lands have new regulations around the farming of hemp. These include sample testing of the plants to ensure their THC levels are low enough to be considered hemp, and a plan to dispose of any plants that test too high. And Navajo leaders, like President Jonathan Nez, say Banali must follow the new federal rules and get permission from the nation to raise a hemp crop.
And we just want to be able to do it correctly and protect our Navajo people that want to utilize that product on our nation.
Banali says he will work to ensure he is meeting the new federal and tribal guidelines, and he understands cooperation ensures success.
We have to work together. That's all I realized, to get this going and take it to the next level.
And Banali hopes that next level means seeing more of this green across the red sandstone of the Navajo Nation. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Marcela Bayeto with Cronkite News in Shiprock, New Mexico.
And on the NewsHour online, we have more takeaways and key moments from today's hearing with Attorney General William Barr. That's on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.